And we return 7 minutes past 1 o'clock. It is today's Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman on this Thursday afternoon. Well, this hour we begin with a discussion of Miami-Dade homeless issues. For many years, the Miami-Dade Homeless Trust has been a national model for its treatment of those on the streets and the indigent. The trust funds some $54 million a year for housing and services. Joining us is attorney and Miami-Dade Homeless Trust board chairman. He's Ron Book. Welcome to you, Mr. Book.
Thank you very much, and we appreciate the invitation to be on your show.
Glad to have you. Also with us is Trust Board member and the president and CEO of Camilla's House, Dr. Paul R. Camilla's is a nonprofit which provides humanitarian services to indigent and homeless populations. Welcome to you.
Thank you, Bonnie. I need to set the record straight that I am not a member of the board.
Oh.
I'm a fan of the board. So.
We
have several of our folks affiliated.
Oh, our mistake.
No problem.
Apologize.
No problem. Yeah, I take it as a compliment.
Okay. Well, I'll ask, Ron Book, let me ask you. I'd like you to clarify the U.S. Housing and Urban Development's requirement to end the chronic homelessness by 2015. What does that mean, and what happens if it's not achieved? Are there sanctions that are going to be imposed?
Seems awfully ambitious.
Yeah.
It is an ambitious plan, but if you don't set goals and you don't set targets to hit, you never get where you want to go. Do we think that HUD's goal of ending chronic homelessness by 2015 is realistic? The answer is they've put some things in place that help us get there. The 100,000 homes program, which we're participating in Miami-Dade, is a part of that. There are formulas that you work at so that you know how many people each day, each week, each month you will have to get off the streets in order to achieve that goal by 2015, and our staff is working at that. I had an opportunity to visit yesterday with one of your colleagues, and we talked a little bit about our anti-panhandling thing. That's something that will be heard on another one of the shows here in a couple of weeks, and we talked a little bit about that issue. Do I realistically believe we will end chronic homelessness by 2015? I believe that what HUD has said to us is we need to engage all of that chronic population in the time. We believe we will have housing and services available to the chronic population by 2015. But realistically, in an honest conversation where you lay everything out on the table, we don't have all the answers to the mental health issues that affect the chronic population. We don't have all of the answers to the co-occurring issues that chronic homeless individuals suffer from, whether that's a co-occurring issues, mental health and substance abuse, co-occurring mental health and alcohol abuse, or some combination of all three. We don't have a magic cube that says we're going to solve those issues immediately. What we do know is that our investment in proven programs that get people off the streets largely work, and that we have been very successful in engaging the chronic population largely in our Housing First programs that we help fund. And Camillus, for example, is one of our Housing First providers. We believe in the programs as a general rule that Camillus operates, and they are one of our significant providers. That's why we contract with them. And if you look at the numbers that Camillus and some of our other providers have utilized, Citrus, Better Way, Carrefour, our numbers are tremendously successful. While we have 21 outreach teams that are out there every day working to engage the population, and we learn a lot from our point-in-time surveys that are done in August and January of each year, which allow us to readjust our priorities and put our resources where we get the best bang for its buck. We will use all of our resources, all of our human resources, all of our financial resources to move that chronic population off the street by 2015.
I'd like to bring Dr. Paul R. into the conversation. Paul R., you're the head of one of the most visible homeless and service organizations in the county. Give us your views on the HUD request or mandate, so to speak. And also, you've been in the your new facilities now well over a year, I suppose, and that was quite a battle for decades. Give us a progress report on Camillus House.
Well, let's talk about HUD first.
Okay.
Ron is right. Numbers work as a motivator. Last comparison I saw, Ron ranked Miami-Dade County only behind Philadelphia in terms of the fewest number of people unsheltered homeless in their population. So we're within striking distance of the lead. As a matter of fact, we could already be the community with the lowest number.
And considering our climate, that really is really saying something.
Yeah.
Well, I would say this, that...
And the economy.
I would say that the... In the case of Camillus, where we focus primarily on chronically homeless, that that's not really a consideration for us, but it is for Ron, insofar as Ron is dealing with the entire array of homeless folks. Our folks really are so disabled that they're not likely to get a bus ticket in Oklahoma City and come here. I think Ron would agree. Most of the folks that are chronically homeless in Miami-Dade County, last time the trust counted, I think roughly three quarters of them have been either here all their lives or for at least 5 years.
Well, there was a census taken in January. What were the results?
Well, we were just a smidgen up. But I want to go to a couple points not only Paul has referred to, but Bonnie did. The answer is we're not going to get sanctioned if we don't meet the goal.
Okay.
However, our partners in this are the United States Department of Housing and Urban Development. $33, $34 million a year comes into our community from HUD. Because they recognize our program as a leading program in the country. They've recognized it historically as a best practice model. They have recognized our outcome and performance numbers. That said, you know, when all things are said and done, if you roll the clock back 20 years, the NIMBYs that fought us on locating our homeless assistance center on North Miami Avenue and later down in Homestead, they all said that the food and beverage tax and our continuum of care was going to be a magnet for people coming here from all over America. And let me tell you what we found. That's just didn't occur. We said it wouldn't occur. It hasn't occurred, number one. And number two, as important as anything else that we talk about today, we get criticized as a community all of the time for all we do wrong here. One of the things we do right is homelessness. We have places like Camillus that we contract with that are leaders in helping Carrefour, Better Way, the Rescue Mission, the Salvation, that help us in that fight. The business community is engaged. The school system is engaged. And the county has allowed us to do our thing for 20 years without intervening and interfering with what we do. And we're the only urban community in the United States that during the economic downturn has not had an uptick of any significance in our street homeless population during this terribly bad time. So when you talk about the economics of our community, it just hasn't happened. Look, are we still unhappy with having 860 or so people living on the streets tonight when we put our heads on our pillows? You bet. Do we need to continue to have our entire 2.5 million people population of Miami-Dade County, the 4 million people that live in South Florida, engaged in what we do? You bet we do. But we're winning. But we're not done. And the chronic population, the 40 or so percent, 45%, 42% of the total that are still on our streets, it's going to take increased resources to get them off the streets. We can't quit.
But I just want to make one comment on Ron's. In 2013, the number of sheltered homeless people in New York City was up 71% over 2002. 111,000 people, individuals, spent at least one night in a shelter in New York City. So Ron's exactly right. We are not a magnet. We're perfectly capable in South Florida to create our own homelessness. And homelessness is created by overall economic conditions. And I think that the good news is when you go downtown, you see that the economy is really picking up And that's going to help all of us to get more resources to solve the problem.
I wanted to understand the old terms of the Pottinger Agreement and the new terms that were unanimously passed by the City Commission. And is that going to go into effect? Can you just explain that, Ron?
The court has not yet entered an order on the Pottinger resolution, amended resolution.
It comes tomorrow.
I'm not a big fan of the changes in the Pottinger decision.
This is the mat business.
The consent thing.
Well, it's more than the mats.
The mats are simply a piece of it. And I will begin this by saying reasonable people in this world are entitled to disagree, and it doesn't make one side more right than the other or more wrong than the other. I think there were probably some things that could have been clarified under the original Pottinger Agreement that, as you all know, was
just a brief history of that, just a thumbnail.
Well, there was a lawsuit.
It goes back to the 80s.
There was a lawsuit that began almost 20 years ago. None of us were really engaged at the time from a homeless trust perspective as to what ultimately was entered into as an agreement by both sides. The group of plaintiffs, the Michael Pottinger and his group of homeless folks represented by the ACLU et al. Legal Services and the City of Miami. And I will remind you that Pottinger only exists in the geographic boundaries of the City of Miami. Mm-hmm. It does not exist as a decision, as an agreement, outside of the geographic boundaries of the City of Miami. It's a big county.
Municipalities can handle it differently.
Nothing involved in Pottinger applies in North Miami Beach, mm-hmm. North Miami, Surfside, Bal Harbor, Miami Beach, Homestead, Florida City, anywhere in our community. It is in the geographic boundaries of the city. The two sides ultimately, by the initiation by the defendants, City of Miami, they went back to court in an attempt to amend Pottinger. An arbitration, mediation took place. The two sides got together. They reached what they believe are appropriate changes. Some deal with sex offenders. Some deal with those that would have a mat made available to them at Camillus. I would suggest to you that what Pottinger says is that if you're on the streets and a bed is made available to you by law enforcement and you don't take it, they can arrest you.
And that can be a mat.
And that can be a mat. And I can tell you one of the few places where I, as the chairman of the Homeless Trust, and my body disagree with Commissioner Sarnoff and the program that they are attempting to implement at Camillus House. We don't agree with the MAP program. We just don't. And there are reasons for that.
And your views, Dr. R?
Well, our views are that in order to convince the city fathers and mother in 2007 that we were capable of operating a facility that didn't have 40 to 60 people out in front of it every night, which was part of the resistance to moving Jason to Alapatta, was that we opened up our parking lot to the folks that were historically been on the street. We designed a program for between 40 and 60 people. At the point at which we ran out of space with mats in our dining room and our hallways, we had 280 people who voluntarily came in. When we ran out of money, we charged them a fee. They paid the fee. So from our perspective, there are probably at least 100 folks that are willing to come in and spend the day and the night at Camillus and get their case management, because these are, we have 175 people that come to our day program that leave at 3 o'clock every day and go back to the street. As far as we're concerned, if there's not 100 people out there, we'll shut it down. But I don't see where there's a downside to it. First of all, Carol Person's research says that people do better in housing first if they come from some other place rather than directly off the street. This is a some other place.
Because they also may be getting substance abuse treatment.
Well, he's going to meetings.
Well, I'm just saying that that's the research that says that if you come from a jail, if you come from a mental hospital, in that case, the longevity is longer. This would qualify as far as the services that we provide. And the our point is that everyone benefits from it. The clients benefit if they voluntarily come. Now, Ron, you know that we're not presenting this as a Pottinger set of beds. We're presenting it, as we did before, as a service to the community. Downtown businesses and residents would see fewer people downtown. Essentially, we would have folks that were at least crossed the threshold into a major treatment and rehabilitation facility.
What's the role of the Downtown Development Authority?
Well, let me digress, and I'll come to the DDA, because I don't think the DDA has any authority in any of this, although they've been a catalyst for a lot of the changes that were suggested.
They don't want homeless people downtown.
Right. Yeah, they don't want them on their doorstep, and I got that, and nobody should. But the truth of the matter is, we believe the chronic population, which is the population that Commissioner Sarnoff in his arrest and release revolving door plan had originally proposed and has now worked to implement together with the DDA, the population they're targeting is the chronic population. We know how difficult that population is. We believe anything that interferes with our ability to make it harder for people to stay on the streets interferes with the long-term solutions to the chronic population. We believe a MAT program, which they had operated in Orlando 20-some-odd years ago. 20-some-odd years ago, Alva Chapman, myself, and a number of other community leaders, Alex Pinellas, Monsignor Walsh, Archbishop McCarthy, Rabbi Solomon Schiff, Armando Cadena, we went to Orlando. We went to see what they did. They had a MAT program. They ran that program for over 25 years. Guess what? 8 months ago, Orlando was designated in America the number one most chronic populated homeless community, period, bar none. So they just closed their MAT program 4 months ago because it didn't work.
And why doesn't it work?
It doesn't work because it doesn't provide long-term care services and getting people off the street. We have a respectful disagreement on this issue. And I would suggest to you that while Mr. R and I have had conversations, his chairman, Mr. Dickinson, and I have, we've recently gone back and looked at the numbers during the period that Camillus ran a MAT program. Here are what the facts are. We count twice a year. In January and August of 2007, January 2007, there were 158 people in the geographic confines. August 2007, 298. January 2008, 253. January 2009, 192. August 2009, 361. January 2010, 286. September 10th, 2010, 273. January 2011, 300. June 2011, 338. And January 2012, 338 in the confines of the geographic area of the city of Miami. If the MAT program worked to reduce the population on the street, it would reflect in those numbers. It doesn't. I didn't make these numbers up. They're the numbers that were published back then. It's real. Paul R., Bob Dickinson, the Camillus Board did nothing to create this program. I want to go back to the DDA in the city of Miami for a minute. The city of Miami came to us back in July and August and said, we want you to give us mats. We said, we won't give you mats. We won't fund mats. We will never fund mats. We're not into mats. We don't believe it fits. We believe in proven solutions that are well established and give us the greatest rate of return of reducing homelessness. We refused to fund it. We entered into negotiations with them. We ultimately agreed to fund 77 new beds with our money in the geographic boundaries of the city of Miami in exchange for the city funding 20 beds. We put out a bid. We got a successful bidder to bid. I wonder who that was. Or that was Camilla's house at $19 a day. We signed our piece of it.
Which includes three meals. And
includes
and
meals.
Everything else.
We have a disagreement about case management. I believe if under our deal with Camilla's, at $19 a day, they could have provided case management services and meals without a problem. If you simply take what the city agreed to do, which was to agreed to fund those beginning October 1, here's what we've lost. They failed to implement anything. There is nothing implemented in the way of a MAT program today or permanent beds. We procured it based on a good faith negotiation, a handshake agreement, a resolution adopted by the City of Miami to ratify it, ratified by the Board of County Commissioners, ratified by the Homeless Trust. They've implemented not one bed. From October 1 to today, this moment in time, we have lost 2,980 beds through today. Unfortunately, because the city, in this so-called agreement to provide mats to Camillus, they have yet to give this Camillus the money to fund that. And if you took simply the money they were willing to give to us, they would get $6 a day per person. You cannot provide housing, showers, three meals a day, case management and services. You just can't for $6 a day. How do I know that? I'm doing this for 20 years. We procure this.
What does it take?
$19 a day, $19 a day, $21 a day, $23 a day, depending on which provider we've got. But on the average, $19 a day. That's what we pay Camillus to do this.
Well, you pay us a little more, but that's
we do
in the ballpark.
When you do the aggregate.
Well, what happened to these?
Because the city, in bad faith, has not done what they said they would do, because they did the bait and switch. And what they did is they never intended to allow us to buy beds, which we were doing with Camillus, 20 beds. We had done a bid. We had contracted with them. They sat empty. Those 20 beds that
still
they
empty.
Put aside
still empty.
Sat empty. They've made no revenue on it. They've had no bodies in those beds. Empty. They then bait and switched us after the Pottinger agreement got amended, and they did what they intended to do all along, which was to induce us to give them new beds with services, while they took their piece that they had promised to commit to beds, put it into a MAT program. The MAT program, now that they've agreed to do with Camillus, they can't afford to do with the money they've got. And they've told Camillus, go out and raise your own money to do this with us. And oh, by the way, then we'll match the rest of it with you. They got to go raise $170,000 in private sector funds, and the city allegedly is going to give them the balance. Here's what I know. We are October, November, December, January, February. We are five full months later, 2,980 bed nights that we could have had homeless people in beds that they have robbed from our efforts to end homelessness in the community. Call it whatever you want to call it. Here's what I call it. I don't take any prisoners in this game. I don't make money from fighting to end homelessness in our community. I'm fairly objective. Am I strong-minded? Am I pig-headed about it? Yeah. I don't take prisoners when it comes to this. Some people like what I have to say. Some people don't. But at the end of the day, I'm into ending homelessness as Camillus House is. And when political people interfere for their own selfish purposes, whatever that is, and I've yet to have Commissioner Sarnoff agree to meet me at a radio station or a television station, including yours, to have any meaningful discussion about where the right and the wrong are here.
Well, we'll see what we can do with that. We only have a short amount of time, but Dr. R., what is Camillus House's biggest source of income?
The largest source of income comes through the Homeless Trust from HUD, and we're a major recipient of the Homeless Trust funds. We raise about $5 million a year, and of course...
There's donations.
Donations, events and those, and you know that we raised over $80 million to build the new facility, which is fully operational.
Can I ask one more question?
Okay.
Do we have time? I just want to ask about the population of children. You said you did a separate census on ages 13, children, really, ages 13 to 24. And where are they coming from, and what number, what percentage of the number are children?
Well, Ron's the expert here. We have because our focus is on chronic illness, we're basically dealing primarily with single men. But Ron, you've got the numbers.
And very briefly, Mr. Book.
It's hard to do the kids piece briefly, but I'll do the best I can. Here's what we know. There are 330, 340, 350 unaccompanied youth. We did an eye count, which is what the youth count is. We've never been required by HUD to do it before. We actually did when it didn't count, when HUD didn't require it. We did a count in August. Why? Because when the count meant something by HUD's requirements, in January of this year, We wanted to be ready. We wanted to be better prepared. We wanted to understand where they are. They're all over our community.
What are they, runaways? Are they they're banished from their homes?
They're a combination of everything known to man and womankind. And unfortunately, hard times create couch surfers in friends and family members' homes. They're unaccompanied youth. They're runaways. They're shunned. They're people who, for different reasons, aren't living in their home.
Well, we certainly want to thank both of you for coming.
I wish we had longer.
We're out of time.
Maybe we could.
We've been
back.
Speaking with the president and CEO of Camilla's House, Dr. Paul R., and also attorney Ron Book. He's the chairman of the Miami-Dade Homeless Trust Board. Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thank you for joining us and for your work.
Thank you. We'll come back anytime.
Food Good. And Dining up next. And we're back. It is today's Topical Currents Thursday edition, of course. Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman. And joining us now, as usual, chef, Cordon Bleu chef, author, syndicated columnist, Linda Gassenheimer. And what's on the menu today? Although this really isn't a menu program. Well, I guess it is, too.
Well, wait and see. Hello, Joe. Hello, Bonnie.
Hi.
Hi. Okay, heart health. That's on the menu. February's Heart Awareness Month. And here's a question. Can we tune up our heart health? And can we prevent and reverse heart disease? Well, our guest says yes. And he's Dr. Stephen Masley. He's a well-respected cardiologist. And his book is The 30-Day Heart Tune-Up, A Breakthrough Medical Plan to Prevent and Reverse Heart Disease. Let's welcome Dr. Masley. Are you with us?
I'm delighted to be here.
Great to have you with us. And we'd also love to hear from you, our listeners. Do you have any questions for Dr. Masley? Give us a call. That's 800-743-9576, 800-743-WLRN. Bonnie, do we have email?
We do, radio@WLRN.org.
And of course, with us is our favorite wine guy, Fred Tasker. He's joining us by Skype. And Fred gives the wine suggestions for my Dinner in Minutes column that you can read in today's Miami Herald. And you can also read Fred's wine column in today's Herald. Fred, are we drinking today? Do we have Fred? Well, we'll get him if we don't have him at the moment.
We'll work on it.
Okay, thank you. Well, let's go to Dr. Stephen Masley. Heart health. Now, your book talks about the truths and the myths of cardiovascular risks. So what are some of the common myths? I mean, let's start with something like the cholesterol medications like statins. What's a myth here?
So one of the big myths is that people think of their cholesterol as the most important thing for their heart, but that's really not true. It is a significant factor, but it's not really your total cholesterol that makes a difference at all. The biggest myth is that people can prevent future heart attacks and strokes by having a procedure. When people have bypass surgery or when they have a stent, they're treating a symptom, but it really doesn't protect them in the future, but their lifestyle can.
Well, let's talk about that for a minute. When you say, well, obviously, if they've had the stent or open heart surgery, it is saving their lives.
If you're having a heart attack, you have a blocked artery, and opening that can be absolutely life-saving, and it saves the heart from damage. But most procedures people have aren't because you're having a heart attack. They're looking at what can we do to help your symptoms. And it doesn't prevent you from having a future heart attack or stroke.
Okay, so people taking statins, they think, oh, gosh, I'm okay. I'm taking a statin and I can eat whatever I want. That's a cholesterol-lowering drug.
But I think you probably know that's completely not true.
Right, but I want to hear from you.
When you're on a cholesterol med, it lowers your numbers, but most people on a med, if that's all they do, they're still growing plaque. So the lining of their arteries thickening, they're growing plaque despite taking the medication. But if you do everything right, you can actually shrink the plaque with or without medications. Help you shrink plaque if the commercials on TV actually get it right. You know, they say when combined with a healthy lifestyle, these things can help prevent heart disease. That's true.
So,
but the meds by themselves don't work.
Okay, so Dr. Masley, what is everything right? When you say we can do everything right, what should we be doing?
Well, this is that's a great question, because we've looked in our clinic at what predicts the age of your arteries. We've looked at hundreds of markers on almost 1,000 patients to explore that question. We found cholesterol wasn't predictive really at all of whether you have plaque growing in your arteries or not. The things that were predictive and are really powerful are fiber intake, fruit, vegetable, beans, and nuts. Fitness, how fit are you? What's your body fat? And notice these factors are all Fs, just coincidentally. So fiber, fitness, body fat, fish and fish oil intake, and their specific food nutrients that are just awesome for your heart.
Okay, well, okay, so that's a big list. Let's go slowly through. So what you're really saying is to eat the right kinds of foods is as important as perhaps taking medications. Is that what you're saying?
I would say it's much more important. Medications do have value, but you can prevent and reverse heart disease with the lifestyle food choices. You can't just take a med and expect it to work. It won't.
Okay. So, well, let's give out our phone number again, because many people may have some questions for you. That's 800-743-9576, 800-743-WLRN. Have you been taking statins and think you're just fine, or have you been eating right? Or let's go back to...
Let's see if we've hooked up with Fred. Fred, are you there?
I'm here.
Oh, Fred. Okay, we've got you now. Did you get cold and frozen up there in the north?
Must have frozen the lines. I don't know.
Okay, so we're going to be drinking today, right?
Absolutely.
Okay, we'll come up with that. And we can find out from Dr. Masley if you're allowed to. So we'll ask him that later.
Dr. Masley, what have I heard recently about people saying that they can have all the fat they want and all the red meat they want, and that has nothing to do with heart disease? Is that a myth?
I don't think that's an accurate reflection. I think low fat is probably something we're realizing was a lot less effective than we had ever hoped.
Okay.
It's the type of fat that makes a huge difference. So you could, if you have a lot of bad fat, that's just as bad for you as it ever was. The difference is, we know, like for the Mediterranean Heart Study that's just been published in multiple ways, adding more virgin olive oil decreases your risk for heart attack and stroke. And here was what was interesting. When people added more, they didn't gain weight. By adding more olive oil either. So that's kind of another myth breaker right there.
Right.
So olive oil, nuts, avocado, seafood, those are excellent fats, and we need more of them.
Right. And I think today the USDA, the FDA, they're coming out with a new nutrition label talking about that. I think talking to that subject, that it's not just the fats that we should look at, because there are good and bad fats. It's more what kind of foods we should be having.
Well, they're also going to have total calorie count instead of calories per serving.
Right.
Like if you have a can of soda, it's not going to have, you know, per serving. It's going to be the entire...
The 12-ounce bottle of soda.
Exactly.
Right. And a half a cup of ice cream. Did you ever eat just a half a cup?
Exactly.
I think that's what they're going to be talking about. So, Dr. Masley, you're talking about eating the right kinds of foods. Tell us what foods we should not be eating.
Well, the biggest predictor of heart disease is sugar intake. So sugar as in regular sugar. But also, here's the thing that most people don't think of. When we have flour, when we grind up, you know, a grain into flour, and whether it's white flour or a whole grain flour, it has almost the same blood sugar effect as eating plain sugar. So when I say a refined carb or a processed carbohydrate, I put flour and sugar into the same category. So that's number one.
Can I ask you first, are you talking about just white flour? What about whole wheat flour?
I'm saying whole wheat flour. Well, from a sugar perspective, they're almost identical.
Okay.
Yes, whole wheat flour has nutrients for your intestinal tract. But from the sugar perspective and how harmful sugar is to your blood vessels and your risk factors for heart disease, they have the same effect. So that's really a breakthrough to look at flour and sugar. For people who have weight issues or blood sugar issues, That, you know, if you're really an athlete, you can probably have more whole grain flour, but most people aren't. The second category that's really harmful to our hearts are trans fat, partially hydrogenated fats. You know, the FDA is talking about banning them, but it hasn't happened. They're still a big part of calorie intake today.
Right. And, well, it's kind of easier to avoid trans fats. I mean, that's on all the labels now. You can see what they are. It's kind of hard to stay away of. Are you saying no carbohydrates? What are you saying here?
No, I would say I like a high fiber, low refined carb, low processed carbohydrate intake. So that would be take sugar out, take most flour out, and most of our carbs would be from fruit, vegetable, beans, and nuts. I think that would be an excellent diet for your heart, for your waistline, for losing weight, for brain function, for all of those things.
And what are the best sources of fiber? Would that be fruits and vegetables then?
Vegetable, fruit, beans, and nuts, those are all incredible. They're excellent. And we should be getting 30 grams a day. An apple has 3. A cup of broccoli has about 3. Average American is probably getting 12.
Right. I was going to say, it's really hard. I think the government guidelines are for 25 grams of fat of fiber a day. It's very, very hard to get that much fiber. I think you need to eat a lot of beans or...
10 apples.
Well, there are
yeah,
some...
Yeah, but I would actually say it's here... I would like to provide recipes. You know, the whole part about the 30-day heart tune-up, we're trying to make it easy. We want it to be easy for people to get this fiber. So like a protein shake for breakfast. You know, you're going to add blueberries with some almond milk, a shot of protein powder. You're going to easily get 5 or 6 grams of fiber with your breakfast. You could have, you know, another piece of fruit some other time during the day. 2 cups of vegetables, 1 handful of nuts, maybe 1/4 to 1/2 cup of beans a day in a soup or as a side dish. We're actually there. We made it.
There you are. Okay, well, on that note, we're going to take a short break here. I'm Linda Gassenheimer. My guest is Dr. Stephen Masley. He's been talking about preventing and reversing heart disease. We'll take a short break, and we'll be back with more. And we're back. I'm Linda Gassenheimer, and our guest is Dr. Stephen Masley. He's the author of The 30-Day Heart Tune-Up. He's been giving us some great advice on how to prevent and reverse heart disease, which is also part of the title of his book. So, doctor, I'm going to give you a dinner in minutes now, and it's hopefully a heart-healthy one. I think it's quick and easy, and I think it's heart-friendly. It's a nutty baked shrimp with Roman spinach and orzo. And the kind of cooking I do for this leaves the shrimp really juicy and full of flavor, and then I add some crunchy walnuts and just a little bit of Parmesan cheese for some texture and flavor. So just take the shrimp, shelled shrimp, and put it in a small baking dish, sprinkle with a few breadcrumbs, drizzle a little olive oil over them, and a little white wine. Bake it for about 10 minutes at 350 degrees. Remove it, and then you sprinkle some of the walnuts and Parmesan cheese on top and put it on the broiler for a minute. Now, the healthy secret here is the quantities, because you want to get that flavor without too many calories. While the shrimp bakes, boil orzo, that's the rice-shaped pasta, about 10 minutes. Add some spinach. The spinach will just melt in the hot water. Drain it. Olive oil, salt, and pepper, and that's your dinner. It's really simple. That complete recipe in a photo. It's at dinnerinminutes.com. If you want another quick dinner, it's a chicken one. It's in today's Miami Herald. It's sherry mushroom sauce with herbed rice. And you can please follow me on Twitter. That's at L. Gassenheimer. Okay, we've got Fred now. Fred, what are we drinking?
Well, I don't think I'm a doctor enough to be qualified to talk about wine and health. I want to ask the doctor about that in a minute. But I thought first I would talk about grapevines and healthy grapes and good wines. Now, I wrote a story for the Miami Herald recently for the South Beach Wine and Food Festival. And I interviewed Chuck Wagner, who was a 62-year-old winemaker, and he's the owner of Camus Vineyards in California. He was honored there for his life's work. And in the interview, Mr. Wagner talked about some very fascinating things that he's learned in 42 years of growing grapes. First, in the 70s, he said his father planted Cabernet Sauvignon, Riesling, and Pinot Noir in Napa Valley. But over time, they learned that while Napa is great for Cabernet, it's too hot for Riesling and Pinot Noir, so they have moved that production over to the Sonoma Coast where it's cooler, and they're getting a lot better wines that way. Second, and this is something I didn't know, it appears that while each individual vine in a vineyard can produce only so much flavor, whether that vine grows a lot of grapes or the grapes are thin so it only grows a few. And it's fairly drastic. Years ago, growers planted 700 vines per acre, and each vine was expected to grow about 20 pounds of grapes. And today they plant more than 4,000 vines per acre, nearly six times as much. But the grapes are thinned so severely that each vine produces only 3 pounds compared to 20 pounds years ago. So you end up with the same tons of grapes per acre from six times as many vines, and you get better wines. I had no idea. But first, I wanted to ask Dr. Masley, can we have some wine? Is that healthy for us?
Yeah, I think some wine with dinner is a great idea. It improves digestion. Red wine has many medical benefits, and the heartier the better. So when you, it helps with flavor, as you know, but it improves clotting, so you're less likely to clot with that meal. It improves your blood sugar levels. I'm a big fan of having a glass of wine with dinner.
I think Fred just became a big fan of yours.
Absolutely. Well, I have heard that in some nursing homes they give the people a glass of wine to improve their appetite at night too.
Yeah, it does. It helps as we said, it helps digestion. So it helps you digest your food. So your stomach feels better. You're less likely to clot after that meal. Your blood sugar's improved, and it improves your cholesterol profile as well. So I think there's many benefits. The biggest challenge in is limited. Ideally, is one. Two's the max. And unless it's your birthday, really, we should be trying to leave it at that.
Is it true that men can drink a little more wine than women?
Well, it's not just that men are on average bigger. The progesterone and estrogen for women decreases their metabolism, so they remove it. So if the man and a woman have the same size and they drink the same amount per hour, the woman's over time is going to have a higher and higher blood level than the guy.
Higher blood level, meaning what do you mean by
blood
higher?
Blood alcohol.
Because level?
They remove alcohol more slowly. Their liver actually it has to compete with some of the estrogen and progesterone for metabolism. So women remove alcohol from their bloodstream more slowly than men do.
I've never heard the reason for that. That is interesting.
Yeah.
And is red wine better than white?
Well, from a health perspective, I would say yes, because almost all of our lab tests, tend to prefer. If you look at resveratrol content, then your Pinot is going to be the highest. But I like the benefits of a hearty red wine. So a Pinot, Merlot, Cab, something in that category, I think are great.
Right. So Bonnie, do you have an email there?
Yes, Dr. Masley. Mary says, I've read that canola oil is as good in terms of omega-3 fats as olive oil, plus it has a higher smoke point, making it better for frying, and it's cheaper too. Is this correct?
This is a complicated one when we talk about canola oil. So a lot of canola oil is pesticide enriched. So you're having to talk about organic, expeller pressed to hopefully be healthy. And then it does have a higher smoke point. That's absolutely true. But there's a lot of controversy on canola oil use. And then we'd never, when she's less expensive, it's actually probably more expensive to get the organic expeller press type. So for higher heat, I would much prefer nut oils. Avocado oil is excellent for high heat cooking. And then in small quantities, if you don't have a cholesterol problem, you could even look at coconut oil for high heat cooking. But I prefer nut oils and avocado oil.
A lot of people are talking about coconut oil recently, and we've always been taught that it was not good for us. And what you're saying is coconut oil is okay to use. Is that what you're saying?
It's a mixed issue biochemically. So when you have it's good for your brain. So if someone has cognitive decline, memory loss, it helps protect the brain from oxidation, from damage. It's good for the immune system. So like a cancer patient's going to get some immune boosting, but it will raise your cholesterol. If you're using, a couple tablespoons of coconut oil a day or coconut milk, you're going to raise it 30 to 50 points. So if you're
about
a young, healthy
peanut
person.
Peanut oil, is that one of the good nut oils?
Which one?
Peanut
oil?
Peanut is more polyunsaturated. I'd prefer almond, walnut, pistachio nut oils. Again, avocado oil. Those are my favorites, along with, I'm a big fan of olive oil. But if you use extra virgin olive oil, it has a very low smoke point. So you're better off using regular olive oil and using your special extra virgin, like when you're not cooking.
Great. Well, that's very interesting. Those other nut oils you're talking about are very expensive. So how about thinning them down a little bit with a little canola oil? Would you accept that?
Well, but I would only recommend organic expeller pressed canola oil that comes in a glass bottle, and suddenly it's definitely not less expensive. The cheap canola oil, it does have an okay fatty acid profile, but it's, again, very high in pesticide. The ones that, if you buy oil in a plastic bottle, you suck those toxins out of the plastic into the oil. So I think
so glass bottle then for all oils.
For all oils, they definitely should come like in a metal can or a glass bottle. Absolutely. Otherwise, you're pulling all the chemicals out of the plastic into the oil.
Hmm. Well, lots of things to think about. Lots of things to think about. And we're out of time. It's been a very, very interesting week. Dr. Stephen Masley, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
His book is The 30-Day Heart Tune-Up, A Breakthrough Medical Plan to Prevent and Reverse Heart Disease. And we didn't even get to talk about why is the 30 days that magic? But we'll have to get the book and find out. So next week, we'll be talking about...
blank.
All right. We're going to be talking... let me see. I know what we're talking about. I've got it. Yes, I need some coconut oil, I think, doctor.
Yes.
Yes, here I go. We're going to be talking about a beer festival. It's called Sprung, and we'll be talking about that. I'm Linda Gassenheimer. Join me then.
And thanks for tuning in this afternoon. Our producer is Richard Ives. Technical direction by online producer Paul Leary. Find free audio archives and downloads at our website, WLRN.org. More information as well at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Tomorrow at 1, it's Ed Bell and the South Florida Arts Beat. Monday, we return with our annual Florida Legislative Session preview with a distinguished panel. Now, an all-Hollywood actress calendar for February 27th. On this day in 1930, 84 years ago, the birth of Joanne Woodward in Thomasville, Georgia. She appeared with late husband Paul Newman in 10 films. They married after both appeared in The Long Hot Summer. The Three Faces of Eve, Rachel, Rachel. And on this day in 1932, 82 years ago, the birth of screen legend Elizabeth Rosemond Taylor in London. Her parents were American art dealers from St. Louis. She won 2 Best Actress Oscars. Today's recipe at dinnerinminutes.com. One more before we fade to black. On this day in 1993, 21 years ago, 99-year-old actress Lillian Gish dies in New York. Her film career spanned a mere 74 years. She even starred in the racist 1915 film Birth of a Nation. And we leave with a thought from Elizabeth Taylor, known for her distinctive violet eyes and jewelry. Quote, "I am a very committed wife, and I should be committed too for being married so many times." Joseph Cooper with Bonnie Berman. Stay tuned for Here and Now from Where Else But NPR News.